Good morning. It's a delightful burden, if there is such a thing, to be back at CPC. Many of you have joined this community in the last year and a half or so, and so that coming back language won't make any sense to you, but this has been a church with which my family and I have had the most delightful association now for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years. Your senior pastor, Mark Mitchell, and I actually discovered that we had studied together in the same classroom at Menlo Park 23 years ago. We rediscovered that about 6 years ago when Dancy Lee, who at that time was on staff here at the church and was a student of mine at Cambridge, introduced us to this church, and Mark and I became reacquainted. And ever since then, about every year or two, it seems that Mark says, David, can you come and speak while I'm on vacation? Or they've run me out of town again or something like that. And it's my opportunity to stand here. And I say it's a delightful burden, not only because the task of opening the Word of God to God's people is in itself an awesome challenge, but also because you are nourished so well in that way from this platform in this church. I know that because I hear those downloads. I know of the quality of instruction and teaching that flows through the life of this church. And so as I come to CPC, there's a particularly acute question on my mind. And it is, given that they have that kind of nourishment week in and week out, what can I possibly bring that would uplift, that would advance, that would elevate, that would add joy and momentum and wind in the sails to this community of CPC? And as I've thought that through in months and weeks, and then most intensively in the last days when I was doing some work in Southern California, I decided to bring to you this morning thoughts that are very fresh and therefore very raw and somewhat unedited. Thoughts that revolve around the topic of seeing more. Seeing more. And if you'll allow me, I'd like to invite you into the lives of four people whom I've met recently, some of them very, very recently, and ask you to see their world as they do for just a moment before circling round and coming back into our own lives and the challenges and the opportunities that saturate them. I'm not going to use their real names in most cases, not because there's anything embarrassing or clandestine in what I'm going to say, but simply because I haven't had a chance to ask their permission to do so. Julie, not her real name, is a Jewish believer who lives in, a believer in Jesus, who lives in Los Angeles. I met her the day before yesterday in one of those wonderfully quirky, sun-drenched California restaurants. This one in Sebastian's, and along with those other adjectives, I could say obscenely expensive restaurants, but I won't say that because this is being taped. Julie is one of those people, and they seem to be everywhere in California, who knows people and who drops names, not out of any sense of self-elevation or self-importance, but just because that's her life. And so as I chatted with Julie for the first time at a lunch meeting there, she told me about her life, her work in the entertainment industry in L.A., and she casually talked about Mel. And I'm thinking, Mel. Mel. Not Mel the accountant. No. And then it gradually dawned on me that this was the Mel. This was the Mel of recent and unfortunate newsmaking. This is the life that she leads, Julie does, connected to influential, known people in a very narrow niche of humanity that makes much of our media in Los Angeles. Julie grew up in yeshiva school in an Orthodox Jewish family. She's self-confident. She's easily conversational. She's deeply genuine. Julie's love for God doesn't kind of leak out of her personality drop by drop. It's more like a tide that sort of flows across the table at you out of the strength of her person and the strength of her personality. Julie's no fool. In fact, she's pretty brilliant. And she's also brilliantly realistic about the narrow little niche of the world's influential people in whose company she moves. Julie spends half of her time producing and directing films, and the other half as a Jewish advocate for Jesus from inside the Jewish subculture within the entertainment industry in Los Angeles. It might possibly be one of the more interesting callings upon a person's life that I've seen, but it sure isn't one of the easier ones. I have a background in Old Testament studies and rabbinical thinking and so forth, and so Julie and I had a lot of conversation to make. And as we talked about Jewish approaches to Jesus, Julie very smartly engaged my questions. She wasn't hearing them for the first time. She knows about Jewish opposition to Christians whom, as she says, believe in JC. She gets invited to talk about what believing in JC is like in the offices and homes of her Jewish colleagues and friends who don't believe the same things that she believes. She also gets told to stop talking about that when Shabbat comes around and when the moment seems exclusive of JC. Julie's sober. She's realistic. She knows the slow pace at which important things move. Julie has felt, as I believe most of you, and I know I certainly have felt, she's felt the sense of futility that comes when things move too slowly. There's not a triumphalistic bone in Julie's body. There's no inclination towards exaggeration. She just is there doing what God has called her to do. Now, here's the point. When Julie looks out from those intelligent eyes of hers at the entertainment community, of which she's a card-carrying member, Julie sees something more. She sees something more than most people see. She sees the Lord of history at work in subtle but profoundly important ways. She sees him claiming back one life at a time. She has clarity on that fact. She has clarity on the fact that in her moment, and even in her little space in L.A., God is doing something subtle but seismic. The day before I met Julie, I was a little further south in San Diego, and a colleague from OCI and I spent the afternoon with a man named Bishop George McKinney. I will use his real name. I just couldn't think up a name that was fictional that even remotely sounded like Bishop George McKinney, so I just got to come clean on this one and call him what he is. Bishop George is an African-American pastor in a very gang-infested section of San Diego. He's been a friend of the organization that I direct for many years now, long before I came on 2 years ago. But from the time that I joined the OCI team, I've been receiving occasional persistent notes of encouragement from this man, whom I'd never met until 3 or 4 days ago. So we went to visit him and to begin the face-to-face friendship that I hoped would ensue from that promising start, my first chance to meet the guy. I love guys like Bishop George McKinney. He's been in ministry 48 years. He fits that certain profile of the highly educated, very poised, deeply respected black Christian leader, a kind of person to whom I have relatively infrequent access, but kind of personality that just invigorates me. Bishop McKinney lost his wife to cancer 2 years ago, and as we sat and bonded very quickly in conversation, he talked about how he still lives with the loss of that. Still, it's been so recent. He lives with the loss of that. And as he talks about his gene, his wife of so many years, his eyes moisten, but Bishop George doesn't wipe his eyes or apologize for the emotion. He's just there in the conversation, opening his heart. Bishop McKinney recently published a book called The New Slave Masters, in which he speaks some very hard words to his own racial community. But Bishop George is no ivory tower ideologue, just sort of winging criticism out there at less fortunate people. He's doing stuff. He took us around the church area, the neighborhood where they're slowly sort of occupying, to see the daycare center, where children are loved in a stable, enduring way that you can count on from one day to the next. He took us to see the two retirement complexes that they've built. Small but impressive apartments, squeaky clean, safe. Only about 10% of them inhabited by people from the church. The rest a gift to the community, subsidized so it's affordable to people who are from the community. Not long ago, the land where those two apartment complexes stand was occupied by or was covered by crack houses, and the bishop explained to us as we stood there in the sun how they're attempting to take back the neighborhood, as he says, one house at a time and then one block at a time. He talked about the fact that when they gained ownership of this one former crack house and renovated it so that people could have a decent living space in it, that for the first year, gangs drove by and routinely took pot shots into the house from their cars as a sort of way of saying, you have it for now, but it's going to be ours again. And then he said, but you know, I got a phone call from one of the gang leaders the other week. And he said, you know, he said, from one of the OGs. And I had to look that up in Wikipedia. Original gangsta, in case you don't know. George thought I would know that. I'm not sure how. I didn't. He said he got a call from one of those guys. And he said, you know, he said to the bishop, our guys really need some help from the church. Would you be willing to meet with some of them? So now Bishop George is arranging people from within the church and a safe place where these guys can come because these gangsters need some help from the church. And the church is there. The church is there. When Bishop McKinney showed us the fitness room in the retirement complex where members of the church with appropriate skills give fitness training to the elderly people who live there, he turned to me and he said, this is urban ministry. These people have never had anything good in their lives, most of them. And they got some pretty awesome fitness machinery there and a meeting room that makes them proud and all sorts of other stuff going on. You see, Bishop McKinney looks out at his world and he sees God doing something subtle but seismic. He knows it takes a long time, one house at a time, one block at a time. But he's got clarity on the point that the Lord is doing something, and Bishop George is convinced that the Lord isn't even close to being done with what he's doing. Dr. Wu is a man, I'm going to guess he's 35, teaches history at Beida. Some of you may know, have heard that term. Beida is better known in the West as Peking University. Now, a newcomer to China, like I have been for the last 2 years, eventually picks up the fact that you don't call Beijing Peking. That sets you apart as the kind of guy that you don't want to affiliate with. But when you're talking about Peking University, the Stanford of China, I would have said the Harvard if it wasn't for trying to contextualize for some of you out here on the West Coast. The Stanford of China, you don't say Beijing University, you say Peking University, because this place has so much prestige that even with the renaming and the going to a different linguistic format, you didn't change the name of Peking University. Dr. Wu teaches in that place. He knows about the burgeoning house churches and the millions of Christians in China who worship in them. He knows about exciting and loud movements like the Back to Jerusalem movement that you may have heard about. He knows about all that stuff. In fact, when I met him for the first time, we were in a room where some of the leaders of those movements were present. But he didn't want to really get too close to those guys. And so Dr. Wu maneuvered me over into a quiet corner where we could talk. And in his modest, self-deprecating, realistic tones that come very easy to him, very naturally to him, he told me about meeting yearly and then on a more frequent basis, informally, with Christian intellectuals in China, in his own university, in Peking University. Dr. Wu believes, as many, many Chinese Christians do today, that China, within the lifetimes of many of us, will become the most influential Christian nation on earth. He circulates daily with the thought makers, the influential people of China, and he knows how many of them are Christians finding their spiritual community in marketplace churches. Many of them are in government. Many of them are in the universities. It's rumored that practicing Christians go up into the second echelon of the Communist Party. A man spoke to me afterwards today who's had contact with the Chinese military after the first service. He said, "You didn't mention the Chinese military." He said, "I believe that the Christian movement within the Chinese military is something that's happening and astonishing to those of us who get the glimpse at it." Now, Dr. Wu is working with his Chinese compatriots, trying to establish, from a Christian point of view, some of the intellectual and policy framework for the transformation of his country. They work on issues of law from a Christian perspective, issues of ethics from a Christian perspective. What is the role of the intellectual in a society, a Confucian society that respects thought, that respects the thought leader, but the intellectual who is a Christian? What is his or her role in this place? He's in a very exciting seam of history, Dr. Wu is. But he's never written any triumphalistic books about the Christianization of China, and I can guarantee you that he never will. But when Dr. Wu looks out through his little spectacles, almost a caricature of the academic, with that analytical gaze of his and that soft-spoken tone, he sees with clarity that in his nation, God is doing something subtle but seismic. He's got clarity on that point, and so he's bending his energies to doing his part to lay the foundation for a China that perhaps in the not-too-distant future will have experienced that kind of divine attention. If you can stick with me, let me tell you one more story. I met Isha in Cyprus a couple of months ago, 4 or 5 months ago. Isha is an Iranian woman. That's not her real name. I'm guessing she's about my age. Isha is articulate and quiet until she begins to speak about her Iran. Then she becomes effervescent and almost severe in terms of the energy that flows out of her. Not many years ago, Isha explained to me, and a couple of others who were there with her, she was living in one of Iran's second cities, not Tehran, and she, along with several of her friends, had a real encounter with Jesus Christ. Then she said, a little bit later, the bishop came to visit them, taught them the Lord's Prayer, and baptized them. And she says, after that, we were the pastors of the church. And all we knew was the Lord's Prayer. Now, she says, I'm Anglican, but you Westerners have to understand, there were a few of us Westerners there, a handful. She said, you have to understand that I'm Anglican because it was an Anglican bishop that came to baptize us and teach us the Lord's Prayer, but that's sort of an accident. If he'd been a Baptist, then I'd be a Baptist. She says, we're just Christians in Iran. All that, the rest of that stuff doesn't really mean that much. But then she says, it's people like me, like Isha, who know only the Lord's Prayer. She knows a lot more now. She's done a degree in the West in theology and has returned, and I'll tell you about that in a moment. But she said, it's people who only know the Lord's Prayer who are shepherding the Christians of Iran. Now, Isha manages something today called the Iranian Broadcasting Corporation. That's really just Isha, but it has a great ring to it, marketing-wise. She is working with our organization and a couple of others in the Middle East to bring high-quality programming in Arabic and in Farsi, her own language, into an existing satellite delivery system so as to flow quality training into the homes of Arabic and Farsi-speaking Christian believers in the Middle East and around the world. I don't know if you know this about the Middle East, but there is a growing number of believers in Jesus, not coming out of, but emerging in Muslim contexts. And once you're a Muslim, living in a Muslim family, in a Muslim sector of the society, and you come to faith in Jesus, you don't want Sunday school teaching. You want as much as you can get. You want what the Christian pastors get. And so these people are contacting some of the partners that we work with in the Middle East and saying, give us the real stuff. We can't come to your doorway because we'll put ourselves in danger, not to mention you, but we're out there, and there's a growing number of us, and we want training. Do you know that there are, anecdotally, more Muslim background believers coming to Christ today than there have been at any time since the Muslim conquest of the Middle East? This is not in my notes, but I talked with an Arab Christian leader 2 years ago who flew to meet me and some others in San Diego through Atlanta, and he said, when I left my country, I was really excited, really hopeful. He says, but when I changed planes in L.A., I watched CNN, and now I'm depressed. God is doing amazing stuff today in the Middle East, and it's small, and it's under the radar, but believe me, it goes somewhere. It has consequences. You can track the trends. You can see the fingerprints of God. But back to Isha. Isha does not downplay the strength of Islam or the magnitude of the task before Christians in the Middle East and elsewhere. But when Isha looks out from that diminutive frame of hers, through those eyes, at the Farsi-speaking populations of Iran and Afghanistan, Isha sees more than other people do. She understands, because she herself is a product of it, that the lover of nations in our generation is doing something subtle but seismic in that part of the world. Now, I've got to tell you that I have mixed emotions about telling you about each of these encounters with these four people, because there's something demographically different about each of those that distinguishes them from the majority of us. There's something of the exotic about them in comparison to how we live and interpret our own lives. One of them is Jewish. Most of us are not. Another of them is African-American. Most of us are not. One is Chinese, and though we're many Asians here this morning, this is a Chinese man living in a country where the Communist Party has embraced capitalism in one sphere, but resolutely retains political controls in most other spheres. That's not an experience most of us have lived with. Finally, Isha comes from an Islamic country that is today run by mullahs and led by a president who threatens the world with nuclear breakout as we speak. And in contrast to that, you and I, we're so stinking ordinary. We're such regular folks. Or maybe we're not. Maybe we're not. In his letter to the Ephesian Christians, the Apostle Paul appropriates that ability, which was ancient even in his day, to internalize the love and the power of God in such a way that he can look through his own suffering and his own fragility out upon his world and see something that most other people don't see. Like the Israelite prophets before him, and like his own master who collided with Paul's small-mindedness in that encounter on the Damascus Road, Paul gained a vision of God that is far more loving, far more redemptively powerful than he could ever have imagined on his own. For this reason, he says in Ephesians 3:14, for what reason? He says, for the reason that God brings glory even out of my suffering. That's where he's been, and this is where he goes. For this reason, I kneel before the Father, from whom his whole family in heaven and earth derives its name. I pray that out of his glorious riches he may strengthen you with power through his Spirit in your inner being, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith. And listen to this. I pray that you, being rooted and established in love, may have power, together with all the saints, to grasp how wide and how long and how high and how deep is the love of Christ, and to know this love that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled to the measure of all the fullness of God. You see, my brothers and sisters, Paul has so internalized the penetrating, overwhelming, almost unimaginable love of Christ in his own life, so as to see his perception of the world completely re-engineered. Remember this. It's by knowing the magnitude of Christ's love that we begin to understand the majesty of God's project. Let me say that again, because I know from past visits to CPC that there are those who write this stuff down, and then there are others who hook it in their memory. And if anything would pursue you in the week ahead from the time that we've spent, these minutes that we've spent today, I would hope it would be this. It is by knowing the magnitude of Christ's love that we begin to understand the majesty of God's project. We do not become the redemptive persons that we're intended to be merely by coming face to face with the depth of human need. That experience just by itself makes us callous. Or, if your temperament is slightly different, makes us brokenhearted, or bitter, or hopeless, or perhaps a particular plague for Christian believers, duty-bound. But it does not by itself transform us into daring, hopeful, imaginative, sacrificial agents of Christ's love. That only happens when we experience in our own lives how incredibly much Christ is God's yes to all that we are intended to become. It is only by knowing the magnitude of Christ's love that we begin to understand the majesty of His project for this world, for this race of ours. And then as we reflect further on these words from Ephesians that we've read and seen on the screen, may I ask you also to remember this. You see best when you kneel. You see best when you kneel. Paul says, "For this reason I kneel before the Father, from whom every nation gets its name." And he begins to imagine the unimaginable goodness that the Lord has in store for those very nations, a goodness of which he has received a down payment in the redemption of his own miserable life. Kneeling before the Father in a posture of grateful submission doesn't turn us into navel-gazing, hyper-spiritual hermits. It doesn't remove us from the real world. Rather, it is in this posture of prayer, when we ask God to fill us up with Christ's own love, that we begin to see more, that we begin to see the world as God Himself sees us. It is only as we stir our own exposure to the world's need, to our neighbor's need, to our own need, into the process of prayer, that we begin to find clarity about God's true intentions. And with that clarity, we then begin to align ourselves with God's program. We see best. We see best when we kneel. Paul hasn't finished his statements in this vein with the last verse that I've read, which was verse 19. Instead, he continues into this gorgeous doxology, this explosion of praise, this declaration of anticipation beyond what he himself will experience in his own short lifetime. He says in verses 20 to 21, "Now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine, according to his power that is at work within us, to him be glory in the church and in Christ Jesus throughout all generations, forever and ever. Amen." Paul could have sung with us this morning, and I suppose probably would have sung with us those words, "If I don't praise your name, even the rocks will cry out." And then there's another refrain in that song. I didn't write it down, but "the mountains will also sing or shout." I think that one's borrowed from the Psalms. A beautiful, beautiful statement. How can Paul experience Christ's love for this world without ending up in praise? How could we be students of the Bible without ending up in praise? How could we be hearers of sermons and preachers of them without ending up in praise? How could we get 100 million miles from the heart of God and not burst into praise? at the depth and length and breadth and width of his love. That, brothers and sisters, seems to be Paul's experience. You see, a concern for this world that doesn't lead to praise in anticipation is stunted and pessimistic. A concern for human need that is not fueled by the experience of Christ's love for us becomes loveless itself. It becomes conservative to the point even of being reactionary. It becomes a kind of religiousness that hopes only for the smallest victories, and therefore it doesn't engender faith. It celebrates itself as hard-nosed realism, Christianized, perhaps. But in fact, it's a meanness of spirit, and it knows nothing at all about celebration. It knows nothing about that celebration every time God redemptively claims another life, another house, another block, like those ones in San Diego. It expects very little in a kind of heroic effort to avoid disappointment. It doesn't believe in the resurrection from the dead. But when God brings into our lives the love of Christ, as he did to Paul, and then lifts our eyes to the world, there's power, there's redemption, there's participation in the extension of God's kingdom. Remember this: love is passion, and vision is perception. And in Paul's own understanding, if I'm reading him correctly, it's the Lord's power that brings these two together, even in ordinary lives like yours and mine, and makes us agents of his project, of his kingdom, of his rule. Paul prays that people will internalize the unthinkably limitless love of Christ so that, in his words, they will grasp, they will perceive, they will understand, they will get clarity about how powerful his love for the world truly is. He longs to see that in his Ephesian brothers and sisters. He longs to see that powerful blending together of love and vision, of passion and clarity. And then let me ask you, if you're the remembering kind, to remember one more thing. When we see more, as the people whose stories I've told see more, as the Apostle Paul sees more, when we see more, we look beyond our own moment and we prepare others to live out their moment in their time. Paul's doxology here in these verses 20 and 21 anticipates the fact that God will be glorified, as he says, in the church and in Jesus Christ. And then do you notice the reference to time? Throughout all generations. I'd like to focus on those last couple of words for just a moment. Paul, as most of you know, speaks in some of his letters about his own decline, his own imminent death. He also talks a lot about an emerging leadership, people like Timothy, into whom he's pouring his own life. Those are not unrelated facts. They go very much together. You see, Paul sees more in the imagination of faith than his own generation will experience. He sees beyond. He's got clarity on the fact that Christ's redeeming love for his world will outlast Paul's own brief historical moment. And so what does the apostle do? He turns to those who are around him and he builds into the future by investing himself in people who will know greater and better and different things than he ever will. And so Paul can lift up the praise of an anticipator. He can rejoice before time in the unimaginable love of God that he knows will continue to make its mark in the world long after his own voice has gone quiet. Let me see whether I can orient your thoughts and encourage your hearts with just a couple of concluding thoughts here. In worship, in praise, Paul is able to refer to our Lord as He who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine. What do you suppose he's thinking about? In what direction do you think his thoughts are running when he makes that statement? In what direction do your thoughts run when you hear that statement? In what direction does your own imagination flow up to the point where it meets its limit, and from then on out, you have to believe that God has even the unimaginable in store? Or let me ask it another way. Where does your thought process and your imagination process hit the wall and stop? Unable, as Paul would say, to imagine more than that. Is it a relationship? Is it a financial impasse of some kind? Is it peace and justice for Arabs and Israelis, perhaps? Is it the meaningful embracing of Jesus Christ by the gazillions of people around the world whom we abbreviate as Muslims? Is it that? Is it a son or a daughter? Is it perhaps a spiritual awakening in this country and a turning of our lives and our nation's life towards God's purposes in this world? Is it that? Is it the health and vigor of this community of believers? Paul says that he believes that there's a power at work in us, his words, that's able to blow past those walls as though they were made of tissue paper. He doesn't say how. He says we can hardly imagine it. But he says that's what God is doing. That's the depth and breadth and width of Christ's love. Let's carry that love with us as we turn tomorrow and face our week. Thank you very much.